This episode is brought to you by Juul, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. Order now at chefsteps.com/JOULE.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from a little bit even later than normal, around 12:15 today, you know, to around 12:45, like, you know, 1 o'clock, from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia, the Hammer Lopez. How are you doing, Nastasia?
Good.
So, actually, Nastasia and I went on an adventure last week, which we'll see if we have time to talk about our adventure to the great town of Saratoga Springs. But we have two guests in the studio with us today. We have kitchen appliance engineer Joe Zakowski. How you doing?
Good afternoon.
Yeah, and we have the reigning current crown prince of the Museum of Food and Drink, Peter Kim.
Here to spread hate and vacate.
Yeah. What kind of vacate? Number two?
That's actually a line from Exhibit. I don't know if you remember that guy.
I remember. Yeah. With the spelling X.
Yeah, XZ.
Good. So, good.
Anyway.
Strength. We got Dave in the booth.
What up?
How you doing?
Good.
Speaking of Dave in the booth, so a number of months ago, Nastasia and I, along Carlo's in that too, right? In the one we did for Johnny Walker, Dave?
Oh, I wasn't here that day, so I'm not sure, but we do have the episode.
Yeah, so we taped I got to admit, it was like a shill thing. Like, we were like, they were like, hey, will you do this episode for this new Johnny Walker product? And we're like, okay. But anyway, we actually taped a full-on episode.
And if you don't like the wine episode,
you shouldn't go to this one. But we're going to tweet out as the last of Nastasia and Maya's contractual tweet and Instagrams. We will send out a link like that's not in our normal Cooking Issues feed to a Cooking Issues episode where we talk to the rare beast, unfortunately, in the spirits world, but the female master blender, which is awesome. You know what I mean? Need more of that. The industry needs to shift to a more gender parity situation. What?
Balance.
Yeah, balance. All right. Well, how are we gonna start here, Peter? Why don't you before you just start throwing your hate and your vacate? Why don't you drop your plug knowledge for the Museum of Food and Drink?
Oh yeah, so we are working right now on Chow, the Making of Chinese American Cuisine, and basically, yeah, you've got this situation where
I don't think we've talked about it because you haven't let us talk about it on air.
What?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Why don't you explain what the exhibit is?
Yeah, I'm explaining the exhibit, man. All right, jeez.
Before you ask them for money, why don't you at least
I'm not doing it, man. Right,
tell them.
All right. Yeah, so you've got the situation where you've got over 50,000 Chinese restaurants in the U.S. They're all over. And look, so I grew up in the Midwest, right?
Okay.
You know, middle of nowhere, Danville, Illinois.
Whoa, what are you insulting on your upbringing?
It's true. I mean, so anyway, we were one of the only Asian families in the town. And when we wanted to, you know, like I grew up eating like meatloaf and like green bean casserole, but also like, you know, dried squid and other Korean stuff. But when we wanted to go out to eat.
You know what? Dried squid would be nice in the green bean casserole.
Yeah, sure. So when we wanted to go out to eat and we wanted to eat something that wasn't like Olive Garden, it was a Chinese restaurant, and I think, you know, it was really the only option for going out to eat that to have something that was like, you know, quote unquote ethnic. And so that's actually the case in a lot of parts of the country.
You live the Asian version of the Christmas story.
Yeah, basically.
All right.
Yeah, there you go. And so you have this like situation where these restaurants are all around the country. They're all run by Chinese immigrant families. They're serving a menu that I think we all know is not a lot like food in China. And it's one of these things that's become just such a central part of American culture. So what's this, you know, I guess it's a sort of curious situation. We want to know, you know, what the story is behind that. And it turns out there are over 150 years of history behind this cuisine, and so we're going to tell the story of that with the exhibition.
All right, so like to boil that down into like 30 seconds, the number, how many restaurants roughly?
Over 50,000.
That's like three times the number of McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
So there's many more, in fact, there's more Chinese restaurants in the U.S. than Burger King, McDonald's, and Wendy's combined, right?
Yeah,
of course, because there's more McDonald's than any of those other ones, and there's three times as many McDonald's, so more. The other thing I think is really interesting is we kind of take this thing for – we take Chinese food for granted, Chinese-American food, even though it's weird that you have this kind of ubiquitous and kind of monolithic cuisine. I'm not talking about like the new fancy stuff that like, you know, we're not talking about your Danny Bowens or anything like that. We're talking about like old school Chinese-American cuisine. How did this happen that we have a cuisine that is neither cooked by the people who are make so people who own the Chinese restaurant, the recent immigrants, as you put it, normally not all those, some of them 3-4 generations have been having these Chinese restaurants, especially some of the older, more important ones, but they don't cook this food at home, right, for their family,
right, exactly.
typically. And yet here it exists. It's almost like a synthesized cuisine. It's super interesting, unlike Italian American cuisine,
right,
where Italian Americans actually cook that stuff at home.
Everybody does. Who doesn't make like lasagna?
Eggplant palm. Anyway, yeah. but the point is that like that style of food exists as a living home cuisine and as a restaurant cuisine.
Yeah, and it's not just that, but it's like everything around the menu too. You've got the whole sort of format of the meal. You've got the takeout box. You have fortune cookies. You've got sauce packets. You've got like the aesthetic. My point is like it's this whole thing that got developed and like it's just sort of like this crazy story behind it.
Yeah. So the thing is, how'd that happen? That's what the exhibit's about.
Yeah.
How did this happen?
Yeah. Exactly.
You know what I mean? So. And it's going to be tied into a launch of our non brick and mortar based web presence as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we're gonna have a beautiful menu collection. Gonna have tastings, which is going to be a first for us, actual food. Putting the food back in the Museum of Food and Drink.
Yeah.
And then... Peter's like,
there'll still be pellets. Don't worry. For all of you pelletized people out there, there will still be pellets. And we're going to keep the stink machines going.
Yeah, stink machines.
Some of the stink machines.
Yeah, and I saw that in the chat room. Somebody had a problem with it last time with it all smelling like popcorn, pyrazine, whatever. But we fixed that, so... sorry about that.
Yeah, it's like sometimes those valves are literally, there's just like a little valve. Listen, I thank God it wasn't the butyric acid. You know what I mean? The cheesy vomit.
Yeah.
But my point is that sometimes those valves get stuck open a little bit, and so we'd probably need to open and reseal the valves
to
stop them from. Actually, the valves, when they're going wrong, make a kind of a wah-wah noise.
Yeah, that's true.
Like a little. Like a little mini.
Yeah, that's what I was going for.
Little toot noise. Yeah.
Well, anyway, so we have a Kickstarter going for Chow right now. And, you know, when you back the campaign, you get tickets. We're going to have a weekend opening for 2 days. It's going to be on the 4th and the 5th of November.
Spelled
and that's
Chow
gonna be
like
before...
eating, not like Chow.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Chow. Chow Bella. Yeah. So
not like that. Not like that. Like Chow, like
I should make an ice cream called Chow Bella with like CHOW.
Well, interestingly, something you'll learn if you show up at the exhibit is there used to be a Chow Chop Suey Sunday.
Yeah.
Right? That was basically just hacked up little pieces of dried fruit on top of the ice cream. And I have to say that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, man.
You need to bring that one back.
Yeah.
Nastasia, what are your feelings on chewy things on your ice cream?
That sounds good. Like gummy bears?
Well, not that chewy, but yeah, like of that order. But in other words, like in general, like typically for me on an ice cream, I prefer things that like pop and break rather than things that chew.
What about like chendol or like Southeast Asian ice desserts? You got the chewy noodles.
Look,
I love that, man.
I can deal. I'm never like, I can deal, I can enjoy something like that, or like, for instance,
mochi.
Like...
Mochi.
I love mochi.
Oh, that's chewy ice cream? I got you.
All right, that's fair.
Yeah. But it's
like a thing, but like a big grated ice thing with like the cream and stuff and beans. I like it. I enjoy having them, but I'm never like, hey, you know what I'm going to go out and get right now? Do you know what would really fix me up right now? That.
Right. For you, it would actually be a half a grapefruit and a block of cheese.
Sorry. Sorry. Five and a half grapefruits. I really, people yeah. out there, I really,
just
really
so y'all
like
know
grapefruits.
What the thing that he is saying. About
I really,
it.
Really like grapefruits. Don't you ever wake up in the morning and you're like, I need grapefruit? That never happens to you?
No, I love grapefruit.
Joe, you like grapefruit?
It's a high quality yes. fruit. But anyway, let me just get this out.
Well, it's strangely, like, a lot of the ones you buy are incredibly poor quality. Like, it's just like, it's not violently, like, nauseating the way that a bad pistachio is. Mm. But when you, by the way, the way I eat grapefruits, I don't do that, like, you know, I don't do that, like, American 50s thing, cutting them in half and stuff. I just peel them and eat them. But, like, my point is that, like, there's something very, like, just so disappointing about a bad grapefruit. The one where it's just thin, there's no sweetness, all acid, yep. slightly bitter, too much pith. Yep, it's just yep. so disappointing.
Especially the ones that are not, like, juicy when they get dry.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And you can see the segments kind of break apart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you just look at it, and you're so sad. First of all, you paid $2 for that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And then you and you know, you're a reasonably smart person, right? I hope we're all reasonably smart people. So when you pick up the grapefruit, you're picking one that's not too spongy, right? I mean, you know, look, bearing in mind that you know whether it's a California or a Florida grapefruit, so you know what the fundamental skin thickness should be. You're trying to heft the fruit itself to see whether or not it contains enough water and make that judgment. You make that judgment and you get home, and when you still have garbage, like with all of the thinking and $2 later, it's just so disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so go to chow.mofad.org. Chow is spelled C-H-O-W, not the Italian way. And at our Kickstarter, you can get tickets to the private opening of the exhibition, and Dave will be there. I'll be there. We'll be exactly. We'll have some fun surprises for people there, and then you get membership to the museum, and you get to help us out with building the next show. So yeah, go to chow.mofed.org.
Yeah. All right. So and now you can just be hate filled, Emperor Peter from here on out. Strike
fully
me down.
Operational.
Yeah. Well, by the way, Peter and I almost always only talk to each other in Emperor Palpatine voice.
Yeah, yeah. Which sometimes can fade into, like, stereotypical Jewish grandmother.
Wow. Yeah. I never really thought about it. You could do that for me. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But if you feel it later in the show, you can do it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't want to that's, like, a lot to put you on the spot for.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know. Like, so, Joe, what are you working on now?
So, I'm just here to support cooking issues.
Oh, and come on now. If you're on the show, you got to, like, give us, like, what are you working on? Anything you can talk about?
Nothing I can talk about. I'd have to kill you.
Well, I'm sure many people would. Many men wish death upon me to bring out you some. Who's that?
What's that?
You don't know that song? What? Many men wish death upon me?
No.
Many, many men.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wait, you say we got a call, Dave?
Yeah, you want to take a call?
Yeah, let's do it. Oh, by the way, call in your appliance design related questions to Joe Zukowski.
I believe this is sous vide related.
Oh, here we go. All right, I know how to do that.
Caller?
You are.
Hello?
Hey.
Yeah, first question, I just sent the recipe into the Heritage Radio email address. It's for pot de creme. It's basically homemade chocolate pudding.
Right.
But the recipe is how to do it without using the sous vide machine, and I just needed your best guess for a time and temp to do it sous vide, because while it comes out great, the standing there and stirring for at least 20 minutes is just more than a pain.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't have the recipe in front of me because it's on the computer, but most of those set custards are in the 80s range Celsius, So, for instance, like, when I'm doing – so it depends on how much stuff you have in it, right? Like, it all depends on the solids ratio. But – so something that's very liquidy that you don't want to set, like a creme anglaise, I'll do it, like, 82 Celsius. But that'll only be for, like, 15 minutes. And if you were to rock that way for an hour, it wouldn't quite set, but it would be close to set. But you're going to have a much higher egg ratio probably in your custard. And so I would guess, my guess is you're going to want to be somewhere around 85°C. And if it's in a small ramekin situation, I'm assuming when you mean sous vide, you mean like in a combi oven, like in a ramekin, that or in a steam oven, which, by the way, I hear I hear, who was it? I think Cuisinart makes a countertop steam oven now.
That is correct.
Yeah, and I hear it's pretty good.
It's great.
How low a temperature, Joe, can that go to? Do you know?
It can proof.
It can proof. So if you had one of those, you could probably steam set a low temperature a pot de creme, and I would hit it in the 85C range. And depending on how thick it is, usually I'm doing them in relatively thin ramekins. I would probably go on the order of half hour to 40 minutes. But, Joe, do you actually have you done that recipe in one of those ovens?
I have not.
Maybe we can find out a recipe and get back to you. You know, John Darragon, formerly of Please Don't Tell the Bar, has one of those Cuisinart ovens, and he was going off on how it was the greatest thing that's ever happened to him. Do you know what the MSRP on those things is? Roughly?
$150.
That's cheap. It's cheap.
That's my best guess.
What do you fill it on the side like a coffee maker? How do you put the water into it?
It just comes with an infinite amount of water.
Yeah, sure. Anyway. All right, so is this answering your question, I hope?
That's pretty good, pretty clear for that first question. And then I have a completely separate second question.
Alrighty.
Also sous vide related. I'm working on a recipe to do a pork roast with pork and cranberry sous vide.
Mm-hmm.
And the first try I made at it, I didn't quite use enough salt, and it just wasn't really, really tasty.
Right.
And I also didn't pre-brown it. The second try I used what was clearly too much salt, but I also I browned the heck out of it before I put it in the bag, and it got that porky taste, like the that sort of unpleasant porky hint.
Right. Now, are you vacuuming it or are you ziplocking it?
Vacuuming it.
Huh. Because I would usually, that porky taste usually is a fat breakdown oxidation kind of a situation, so I would have assumed that a vacuum bag would take care of that, unless how'd you brown it?
Well, I've had my baking steel parked in my grill for forever, so I just got that as hot as it would get and hit it on, all four of the major sides.
That's unusual. I would guess usually what's considered not pleasant animal flavors come from fat oxidation, and typically, and you did a hard vac on it? It was a hard vacuum?
It's a food saver.
Yeah. I mean, that should be enough to get rid of enough. I mean, like, that would be my guess. I don't know. Maybe someone in the chat room, Dave, has any sort of stuff on this happening. Like, how were the cranberries? Did you pre-cook the cranberries, or were you using dried cranberries?
No, I didn't. I was I put salt and pepper on it, let it sit for a day or two, vacuumed it down for that. And then I opened it up, brushed whatever salt was left on the outside, which basically it had all absorbed.
Right.
Browned it and put it in a fresh bag with the port and cranberries.
Oh, but the cranberries were pre-cooked?
The cranberries were dried.
Dried. You know how they make those dried cranberries? They squish the cranberry juice out of them, and then they use the skins, and then they mix the skins with a boatload of sugar.
Well, I mean,
I don't mind them. I love them. I'm just like saying, like, that's how they make them. It's always curious.
They just really work for several recipes we cook with. I mean, I realize they're not really health food.
I don't really care about it. I'm not a health food kind of a guy. I'm just saying it's like one of those. Actually, I think it's genius. These guys took what is fundamentally a byproduct and they turned it into something that I enjoy eating. My kids enjoy eating. That's even rarer. You know what I mean? And I think that they are useful in recipes.
Trust me, I understand picky children.
Yeah. Well, the other
thing... Oh, God, do I understand picky children?
The other thing about those, if you were to use... even if you were to actually dehydrate your own cranberries, which, by the way, like, I've never tried to eat one of my Christmas strings before, but, like, Peter, you ever eaten one of your Christmas strings when you were a kid? Did you do the cranberries and popcorn?
No.
Nastasia, did you eat cranberries and popcorn when you were a kid?
No.
Joe? I was like dried squid.
None of you guys? Dave?
No. Never heard of that.
Never
heard of it, yeah.
Took a needle and thread and popcorn and cranberries?
Yeah.
Anyway, this stuff when it's left over is like worse than, I don't know. Anyway, the point is that the dried skins are good because they don't get all big and nasty. What are your guys' thoughts on inflated raisins and stews?
Love.
Yeah. Love?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I was freaked out by them because my mom would put the raisins into the stew And then I was like, oh, raisins. I understand what a raisin is. And then it came out as a half grape. It wasn't like fully a grape anymore, but it wasn't a raisin anymore. And I was like, And so like my whole life, like I've learned to like, because they taste good. Like just like strictly speaking, they taste good. And so like, anyway, I don't know. It's a weird, another weird mental problem I have, I guess. You know what I mean? You never had something shock you when you were a kid and it sticks with you for years?
Of course, man, yeah.
That's like I feel like that's Nastasia's whole life.
And I never liked chocolate milk because I have this memory in elementary school of being spilled like everywhere on the lunchroom table and being grossed out by that.
By you? Did you spill it, Dave?
No, it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm. And you still remember that to this day, huh?
Yeah, just like pooling in the lunch tray, like ugh.
That's nasty. I can remember
brown pool.
I can remember biting into a cream filled donut that was moldy, and that I wasn't able to eat cream filling for almost a decade. I was very small, but I still remember. I remember where I was. I was in a waiting room next to the Chock Full of Nuts at the 168th Street Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, where my mom had gotten me something to eat while she was going to go do something for her internship. And I just remember sitting at this freaking chair at 168th Street and biting into this freaking moldy. This is horrifying.
Yeah. As you know, I don't really care about there being mold on my food. So
yeah, he loves it. I can remember my mom frying parsnip chips upstairs for some holiday, and I was violently ill at the time, and associating the smell of frying parsnips with throwing up. And I still, to this day, like a lot of veg chips, I'm like, no thanks, no thank you. You know what I mean? It's like they taste good, but it's just I still got that kind of violent association with them. Again, this is Nastasia's whole life, though. Like, she'll associate whole cities with hanging out with a person she didn't like. I mean, I'm talking as an adult. I'm not talking about as a kid.
Civilizations.
There's a billion of you.
Do I need to go into more detail here?
There's a billion of you out there. If she met one of you and had a bad time, you're all painted with the same brush.
Yep.
And
not just the billion that exists now, but the billions that have existed before them as well.
And the future billions.
And the future billions.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, very strong. Anyway, so back to this question. I don't know what's causing the porkiness. My assumption is that maybe you had a piece of pork with more fat. And it was already slightly oxidized before it went into the bag. I have also done stocks, and sometimes they come out more or less porky, but I don't know whether it's having to do with the actual characteristics of the meat that went in. I think you're protecting it as well as you can by vacuuming it. You want to chill it and vac it as soon as you can. I mean, what I typically do, what I used to do when I wanted to vac something right after a sear down was I would sear it, throw it into a bag, and then immerse that bag unsealed in ice water to chill down the meat, and then I would then you could seal it really quickly. Another thing is you might want to consider. I mean, if it's a recurring thing, then it's clearly just you're getting some sort of reaction where just the initial sear, maybe the sear was at maybe even, I hate to say it, it's too high a temperature and you're getting some off flavors from it. You could do it unseared, but you're just going to have to put a hard sear on afterwards. And when you do it that way, you know you're not going to get any oxidation from the initial sear down. So typically, remember, especially for things like beef or things like short ribs, which is beef, I would recommend the only one I say never to sear beforehand is duck breast. Never sear the duck breast beforehand because it you need it to stay flat so that you can crisp it up in the pan later. But I would say always sear afterwards. Always sear afterwards.
That was always part of the plan. But I was trying to get put a pre-sear on too, and you know, you get more flavor of it actually in the meat.
That's true. I'm a firm believer in that but the thing is it maybe this sear. So I don't know. I don't have like which cut of pork was it?
A shoulder.
Yeah.
Bone-in shoulder.
So, you know, I haven't done a lot of whole bone-in shoulder. I've done some, but I was doing those things mainly more like imitating like a pulled pork or confit, or just salted, like not like heavy seared, because I would leave skin on and then crisp up the skin afterwards. So that more of like, or more like Kahlua pig kind of a presentation of the shoulder. So I haven't had a lot where I do like a hard sear all the way around. It might be that just a long storage in the bag is with that initial sear is causing it to happen. You know what I used to do that I don't do anymore? I used to when I would trim all the meat that I was going to finally have as my portion, and then I would roast all the trim, just roast the hell out of all the trim, and then throw the trim in the bag to get the transfer of brown trim pre-cook flavor into the meat as it was going on long cooks. But as I get older, I get lazier. So,
well, I'm planning to do this recipe for like a 40-50 person party, so I was trying to make it as streamlined as possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, the good news about a shoulder is that it can stand a good bit of crisping on the. You're serving it whole or you're shredding? You're what are you doing? You're going to pull the piece. Is it skin on?
Okay, so what I'm planning to do is get skin on, cook it whole, brown it whole, and then shred it.
Okay.
So you get the little shredded bits mixed in with the rest of the pulled meat.
Yeah, okay. So if you're going to pull it, people like a little bit of textural variation, and I would say to streamline this, make your life easier, I would just get your salt levels right, and then I would, especially if you're going to have the skin on it, because the skin's going to pull and get all wonky, and you have a lot of fat there, and there's a lot of fat there that is relatively soft and prone to oxidation in the skin side of the skin there. So I would cook it whole without searing it, and then I would pull it, and I would do a hard sear at the finish because that's going to crisp up the cracklings. You need a certain amount of time afterwards, even if you've pre-seared, you need a certain amount of time to crisp the crackling up on the outside that you're going to shred into it, and it's going to be more predictable. So, like, even if it's an effect where sometimes you sear it beforehand and you get the porky taste, and sometimes you don't, if it's a piece of meat specific kind of a situation, you can't predict it beforehand. And the worst thing is to have it not taste the way you want when you pull it out of the bag. Do you know what I'm saying?
Trust me, I do.
At the event, so I would just do one more without it, and then try like a slightly slower, like render crisp sear on the pullout, almost like sous vide for insurance.
It's likely to be more predictable if I don't pre-sear.
Yes,
got it. That's also less work, so that's great.
All righty, let us know how it works out.
Thank you, sir.
All right, cool. Dave, should we take a quick break?
Yeah, we can do that.
Let's take a quick break and come back with more cooking issues. This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. If you're listening to this show, you're probably a pretty good cook. Maybe you already know that sous vide is the best way to get a kick-ass juicy steak. And with Joule, a new sous vide tool from Chef Steps, you can do so much more. Smoky tender ribs, homemade yogurt, creme brulee, bright crunchy pickles, vibrant purees, even smooth creamy ice cream, all perfectly cooked every time. Joule is sleek and small enough to fit in your kitchen drawer, and it's operated by an elegant smartphone app that's been designed to remove the guesswork, get you cooking faster, and give you the information and inspiration you want when you want it. Browse Chef Steps' amazing recipes and helpful guides. Choose your perfect doneness for any meat and get notified when your food is ready. You know you'll get great results, so you can focus on sides and sauces, or just pour yourself a cocktail and chill until you're ready for a delicious dinner. For more information and to order yours now, visit chefsteps.com/joule. And we're back. I got some reaction from one of the shows earlier. Andrew writes in regarding my saying that I don't like sweet tea. Because I'm saying I don't like sweet tea. Anyway, he says, a couple weeks ago I wrote in about trying to get a honey flavor in a lavender cocktail. I took your advice and it's been working on perfecting my cocktail. I'll update you on how it's going pretty soon. My issue today refers to something that Dave said on the show. While discussing sweet tea, he said, I hate that stuff. Dave, I understand that you have years of experience in food and technology. I know your palate must be outstanding, or at least it's mine. Your knowledge is obviously immense, but how can I, a child of North Carolina who, by weight, has consumed more sweet tea than flour and water combined, trust you? I'm just curious what your issue with sweet tea is. Do you dislike cold tea? Is it too sweet? Have you had a bitter glass that turned you off on it? What about cocktails? What about in cocktails or desserts? I also like to use tea flavor in meat marinades occasionally. I get it. There's bad sweet tea, but please help me change your mind. I'll do whatever I can. All the best, Andrew. All right. Here's what I don't like, Andrew. Like, I have no problem with cold. I like cold tea. I like cold tea with a modicum of sugar. I think the issue is that, like, let's say I was going to North Carolina barbecue joint, Eastern, of course, because I don't put tomato in my pork. Whatever. Anyway, I'm not going to get off it. I don't want to get you upset because I don't know where in North Carolina you're from. But the stuff that I enjoy the most, I enjoy all North Carolina barbecue, which is, of course, pork and, of course, with thin sauce, vinegar base. I enjoy it all, but I enjoy mostly the more coastal variety that is fundamentally just like pepper, vinegar, and meat. Like, that's like my style. Now, if you're going to go to one of those kind of restaurants in Raleigh or wherever you're going to go, and they have those kind of, I'm looking at them right now, those kind of amber-colored plastic pebbly glasses. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, right, with those things. And they have a jug of what amounts to simple syrup with tea in it, and they pour it, and there's not even any acid because some of these places will not. I know. Now, some of these places won't put it, like, lemon even, like, next to it or with it, and you're just consuming simple syrup tea. I'm like, because I am a thirsty man. I am a thirsty man. Like, that is something that I could enjoy. Like, take for instance, I like overly sweet mint tea, like Moroccan style, or like you know in Paris they have those like those Moroccan tea mint tea joints. Peter, yeah, you like those? He's shaking his head as though you can see his head shake on a microphone. But like the point being that I like sweet tea things in tiny amounts, like. Same way that I like sweet beverages in tiny amounts. That's why cocktails, which are relatively small, can have some sugar in them without freaking me out. But when I am thirsty, I want to pound huge Trump-style quantities of liquids. And so I require them to be not sweet. So iced tea that's a lot lower on sugar, I'm okay with. I like it with a little lemon in it. That's just me. So it's not – I should say – it's not the idea of cold tea that I have a problem with. It's overly sweet tea. Joe, what are your feelings on this?
I agree with you. I don't like it too sweet either.
But do you find that a lot of places will serve it too sweet?
Way too sweet.
Way too sweet, right?
Too much sugar.
Too much freaking sugar. Yeah.
Yeah, too much sugar's not good for you.
Well, I don't. Like I've said before, my health. You know, I just don't like it. That's my thing. What Stas? Do you like cold? You like iced tea?
No, not really.
Wow. Well, Andrew can hate on you. It's all right. But what do you not like about it?
I just don't prefer it. Just don't prefer drinking it.
Don't prefer drinking it.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Like, I wouldn't choose it.
Like, over nothing?
Over nothing, sure, I'll drink it.
All right. Peter, sweet tea?
Not really my jam.
Look, I can appreciate Andrew's position here as a cultural thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But, you know, when I, just not too sweet, that's all.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, whatever. You guys are the worst. Brandon writes in, "Hi, Anastasia. Follow up. I sent my last email before listening to the episode that I shouldn't have read that because you don't know what he's talking about. Something to add to the discussion about tropical tasting fruits that grow in temperate regions. So this is we were talking about the May apple, which is the jelly I make where – actually, that jelly was delicious. Did I bring the jelly in or just the raw fruit for you guys to taste? I think it's just the raw fruit. Anastasia wouldn't taste it because she got no stones. Not willing to risk her life for – good tasting materials. This is really late comment considering that episode was in June, but I figured that Anastasia and Dave and the gang did not mention the pawpaw tree. If you have not heard of it, the pawpaw is native to a large portion of the United States, and is, to my knowledge, one of the only truly tropical-like fruits that grows in the temperate regions of the U.S. In size, shape, and texture, it is similar to a mango, but the taste is kind of a cross between a mango and a banana. Pretty delicious, but very difficult to find. Well, I do know about them, but I haven't really had a lot because they're very hard to ship. I'm only fortuitous enough to have tried it because my architecture and landscape firm specified it in one of our projects. I don't have any questions. I'm just writing to share and figure you all be interested in one of the most under-the-radar delicious fruits that is native to the U.S. So, look, about a month ago, I didn't know you were doing this. I called this guy who has these pawpaw nurseries, but the problem is that I couldn't find someone who would ship me a good pawpaw tree because I'm planning on planting some to see how they – To see how they work. You have pawpaws, Joe?
No, in Connecticut, are you doing that?
Yeah. They grow in Connecticut. They grow. Like Brandon was saying, they grow in most of the temperate regions. They don't ship very well. Like, they're very soft, and they don't ship very well. And I think they're relatively polarizing, and the cultivars are relatively different. So it's kind of hard to get people to, you know, get into it as a commercial fruit. But yes, I plan on sampling pawpaws. What about you, Peter? You got any pawpaws? Mm-mm. Your parents are now in tropical fruit land. Not tropical, like California-style subtropical fruit. Really? Where do they live now?
Outside San Diego.
Of course, me. Weather's nice, me. I told you, there are studies that show that after 2 years, you don't give a crap about the weather anymore. Like, if someone asks you, is the weather nice where you are? You'd be like, yeah, I love it. But, like, you don't rate yourself as happier because the weather is nice?
No.
Nastasia, do you hate good weather because it makes people soft? Is that why you don't like it? Is that why you like it here? Or is it that you just don't like the people in California, and that's why you moved over here?
I don't like the people in California.
Huh. Wow. All you Californians out there, I like you. But Nastasia, not so much. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway. And she's from there. So it's like one of those things where, you know, I always think self-hate's a little weird. But, you know, you can't get down on someone for the self-hate. Can you? Are you allowed to make fun of someone for self-hate?
I don't know.
Peter, what are you? What are your feelings on
the
self-hate?
You're a self-hater.
I feel that you're allowed to have a lot of self-loathing, like, when you're in college. I feel that's what college is about. Like, teenage years, adolescence is about, like, becoming a better person through self-loathing. But I feel you should grow out of it. Mm. What do you think, Peter? No? Joe? Self-loathing?
I think it's more like after college you go through that phase, you know, when you're trying to find yourself or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, then you come out of it. Then you self-loathe for self-loathing. And that's multi-layered. Yeah, exactly. You're like, why am I 36 and still self-loathing?
No, you tell me. You tell me. Yeah. I'm sure it has something to do with the Museum of Food and Drink. Zing, it's funny because it's true. Mm. All right, so.
So I guess Davey just answered the question. It's okay to make fun of people who self-loathe.
Learn by doing.
Man. Yeah, learn by doing. How do you feel now? You've got a big smile on your face. So there's the answer.
Yeah. Hey, look, you know what? Peter can take it. That's why I like working with him. I don't like working with people who can't take it. Do you know what I'm saying? What do you think, Stas? What do you think about people that working with people that can't
we
take it?
We don't like it.
We don't
like
it.
The whole crying thing, the whole, like, I need therapy thing.
Oh, man. No, that's not right.
Know,
if someone needs help.
I'm being facetious.
Yeah, that's not right. I just like working with people that can give and get.
Yeah.
I don't like people that can dish it out and can't take it. God knows right. I take enough. And God knows I dish enough out.
Yes.
Right, Stas? Yeah, Stas is shaking her head up and down. Oh, all right, listen. Yeah. So we had some more information on the butter question we had before. So to tell you what happened, we had a James from Cafe Bezalou in, I think, Seattle, was having a problem with batch to batch. His butter was brittle. Butter was brittle. So he couldn't make like puff pastry or croissant or anything like this because as he was stretching the dough, the butter would shatter into pieces and wouldn't stretch along with the dough, right? And so, you know, he had thought that it had something to do with maybe the feet of the animal or you know, the crystal size. So I wrote to Professor Doug Goff, who is, like, you know, one of the bigwigs, does the ice cream stuff at the University of Guelph. Is that how you pronounce that place? Guelph? Guelph?
I have no idea.
Guelph. Anyway, they have great dairy pages, and I've read them for many years. I really enjoy them. And so I wrote him, and I gave him the question, and here's what he wrote. He wrote, "Hey, Dave, I forwarded your question to one of our faculty members with expertise in lipid technology," which is a fantastic thing. I did not hear from the lipid technologist, which would be a fantastic title, lipid technologist. So you may see a reply from him, but he tells me – which I did not – he tells me that from his experience, this is not uncommon, the brittle butter problem. Hey, say that with a stupid voice, Peter. You're good at that.
I'm not falling for this trap, man.
Come on, man. No. Say it in your I'm announcing the puffing gun voice. brittle butter. You have a good, like, weird announcer voice.
I do that, like, I roll the R.
You do. You know what I'm talking about, Nastasia.
Brittle butter!
That's more like like me at the beginning of the top of the show.
Yeah, I know.
You know what, Dax? Every once in a while, do the beginning of the show. I'm like, no, I'm in the middle of like the house. I can't scream. We have neighbors. Anyway. He tells me from experience that this is not uncommon. It is most likely related to fat crystal size and structure within the butter rather than composition variation. When butter is manufactured, one of the objectives of cream tempering, churning, and working is to achieve very small fat crystals, which then relates to smoother texture, consistency, and pliability. The exact temperatures and times of these stages does relate to composition, and that can vary by feed, etc. After manufacture, many factors, including temperature variation during storage, delivery, and or the age of the butter, and that's also important, the age of the butter, and I'll get more on that later, can cause an increase in fat crystal size. As this happens, butter becomes progressively more coarse in texture and brittle in structure. Think about melting butter to oil and then putting it in the refrigerator to recrystallize. You get a very hard, brittle lump because it was not properly churned and worked. This would be the extreme. So the variation in quality is structure slash texture related and not really primarily a difference in the different kinds of triglycerides that are in the butter. So that he says, I hope this helps. Doug Goff. It did help. So I wrote him and said, thank you, professor. And then I said this. I said, I'll let you know if I hear from your colleague, which I did not. In pondering your response, this is me, I wonder whether mechanical manipulation could help. Whenever I'm going to use butter in biscuits or cake and don't have time to let it temper, I beat it repeatedly with a rolling pin. I've always noticed that this plasticizes the butter. How much of that change is frictional heating? Probably only a small amount. I do not know. Could the effect of beating the cold butter help these folks, i.e., you guys at Cafe Bezalou, or is the effect too macro and wouldn't help them on the smaller scale of a puff paste? And he said, that might help, Dave. Could be worth a try at least. So I would try taking some of the butter that is not working properly and beating the bejesus out of it. But then I saw an article which is available free of charge on the internets that you need to read called The Effective Factors – get ready. Write this one down. The Effective Factors on the Structure of Butter and Other Milk Fat-Based Products by Stein – I guess – how do you pronounce the O with a slash through it? Oh, right? Rönholt. R – O with a slash through it, N-O-L-N-H-O-L-T, September 2013. This article is terrible in the sense that what they really care about is producing lower-fat butter, which, as we all know, is a horrible idea. Horrible. Horrible. But it's a good article in that it talks about every stage step-by-step and what it does to fat crystal size, and it has the extreme advantage of being available on the internet. So as you store butter and the temperature goes up, like let's say it's been tempered up to 20 and then recooled and done a bunch of times, a lot of the smaller crystals and the ones with the lower melting points will melt out to a liquid even though the butter maintains its solid state. And then on recrystallization, slowly in the fridge, we'll get progressively larger crystals, which may be causing some brittleness. Crystal size just increases with time as butter ages in the fridge. So maybe the brittle butter is older butter. But maybe beating the heck out of it actually might help. So they're going to kick us off the air in a minute. But Nastasia and I – actually, I think Nastasia actually enjoyed this trip, which is unusual. Nastasia usually hates most everything. We went to Saratoga Springs. Joe, you ever been to Saratoga Springs?
Yes, I have.
For the horse racing or for the water?
I've been there during the horse racing time, but I didn't go to the horse races.
What were you doing there?
Just with my wife and children.
Did you try the waters? Did you go to the Spa State Park?
I did not go to the Spa State Park.
Oh, my goodness. Peter, have you ever been to Saratoga Springs?
No.
I'm going to go back because – so here's the deal. They have – in Saratoga Springs, there are naturally carbonated water comes out of the ground. I want that to sink in for a minute. Naturally carbonated water comes out of the ground. So and the naturally carbonated water is actually very highly mineralized and saline. So Nastasia, Ariel, who was on the show last week, and my brother-in-law Travis, who was shooting it because we're supposed to write something for Lucky Peach, we went and tasted every one of the natural springs in Saratoga. The race course was closed. We couldn't go to it.
Number two.
Which is the other one?
Lake.
Oh, yeah. There's one in a lake. I went back there later this day afternoon with bathing shorts on, and I just couldn't bring myself to wade in.
How long were you there?
I stayed. I figured, how often do I get to go there? I went and retasted a lot of the waters. Anyway, so, like, this water is pretty amazing because It's very old, very deep groundwater that is super heavily mineralized and saline, and it gets forced up to the surface, close to the surface, through a fault that runs down through Saratoga that's relatively recent. The fault has CO2 coming all the way from the mantle that goes up and pushes the stuff up and charges. And as it comes up, it's mixing with more recent, like kind of recharged rainwater, meteoric water. And there's the interesting thing is there's a shale layer at the top of the ground there that caps it all in. So it's all under pressure. So when you bore down in, it self pumps itself up. So it's not, strictly speaking, an artesian well like you would get where you're actually digging a well where the head of the well is below the water table and you're recharging from a mountain, let's say. It's literally getting forced up and carbonated from below. But unlike a lot of carbonated springs, it's also cool. It's at 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And I think they're delicious. Stas, you liked it too, right?
Yeah.
I brought your bottle, by the way. I think they're delicious. They're super highly mineralized. I made a margarita with the strongest of the waters yesterday. I want to go back, but I have a plea for almost all, in the United States, naturally carbonated springs are in the West, where there's more thermal activity. But if anyone here, I know there's some in Colorado, I know there's some in California, if any of you live near a naturally carbonated spring and for some reason you like us, just get a seltzer bottle, like a carbonated water bottle, fill it up all the way, because otherwise you lose too much through partial pressure. Cap it and send it to us, and we'll taste and talk about your water on the air. I'm super interested in tasting just various naturally carbonated waters from all over the country. But more on Saratoga when I write it up for Lucky Peach, and go visit Saratoga. Good place. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Peter. See you next time. Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.